Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man who I've come to regard as an extraordinary intellect, a man of considerable experience and acumen in the national security arena, is our first guest. He is Dr. Peter Vincent Pry. We're catching up with him as he's about to board an airplane, but I'm very grateful to him for taking a few minutes to talk about some of the issues that he's been focused on for a long time as a career intelligence professional in the Central Intelligence Agency and subsequently in a series of positions on Capitol Hill, also with several presidential and congressional commissions that have been impaneled to look at some important topics like electromagnetic pulse and the condition of our strategic forces. Dr. Pry, thank you so much for finding a few minutes. It's great to catch you. Welcome back.
Always a pleasure to be on your show, Frank.
Let's start with something that I know you have been tracking very closely. You and your co-author, the former director of Central Intelligence, Jim Woolsey, have been writing copiously about the North Korean threat, both that of its missiles, which are increasingly becoming a challenge to our forces and allies and even our own people, I think, but also the possible use of satellites. Give us an update, Peter, in the light of the latest developments out of North Korea.
Well, we're concerned about the recent missile launches that happened where North Korea launched 4 Nodong missiles successfully into the Sea of Japan. These were simultaneous launches, might have been as many as 5. At least 4 of them were successful, indicating a high reliability rate. And these, according to the North Koreans themselves, were practiced to target U.S. military bases for nuclear strikes in Japan. One of the recent developments of great concern to us is revelations in the New York Times that the Obama administration had been using cyber attacks to try to interfere with North Korea's development of ballistic missile launches, to interfere with their launches from the launchers. The implications of this is that up to this point, at least in the open source analysis, people have been assuming that North Korea's efforts to develop long-range ballistic missiles, like the Musudan intermediate-range ballistic missile, were failures because of North Korean technical incompetence. But now it seems, and the world knows, and North Korea now knows, that a major contributing factor to that might have been the cyber warfare activities being conducted by the Obama administration. Simultaneously with that, we have the WikiLeaks dump that tells exactly how the CIA conducts cyber warfare. This is all very bad news in terms of the North Korean nuclear threat, because if our cyber efforts had been making a significant contribution to slowing down the North Korean missile program, we're not going to be able to do that anymore.
And that may just be one piece of why this is problematic. Peter Pry, as you've documented in your writings, you have been warning of the unpredictable character of the North Korean regime and the potential for serious miscalculation on its part. Give us a flavor of how it may respond, in addition to a salvo firing of missiles into the Sea of Japan, to take this a new and much more dangerous step in terms of retaliation against what it might see as American interference with its programs.
One of the major concerns that I and my colleagues have, including the chairman of the EMP Commission, Dr. William Graham, and Jim Woolsey, is the fact that North Korea currently has satellite orbiting over the United States on the optimum trajectory to evade our national missile defenses and to make a nuclear EMP attack that could put an EMP field over all 48 contiguous United States and cause a protracted blackout of our electric grid that could kill 90% of our population in a year from starvation, disease, and societal collapse. That's not some theoretical future threat. That's something that we fear North Korea might be in a position to do right now, because it's got 2 satellites, the KSM-3 and KSM-4, orbiting over this country. And they are under the control of a person who's, frankly, psychotic. You know, Kim Jong-un is Caligula armed with nuclear weapons.
A frightening prospect. Peter, this is against the backdrop of some testimony we received just in the past day or so from senior officials of the United States military, the vice chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the Strategic Forces Command commander, really warning about the very, very problematic condition of our deterrent. They talk about have to do a just-in-time modernization to basically keep it going, that they've really wrung out all of the deterrent juice that you could expect out of aging, in fact, obsolescing systems, really raising a red flag that especially as a North Korea perhaps is making calculations as to whether they could undertake such a frightening scenario, but they might be able to get away with it. What are your thoughts on that, Peter, having studied that issue closely as well?
Well, we are extremely concerned about this. Testimony given by the EMP Commission in 2008, unclassified testimony, noted that the North Koreans probably have got a super EMP weapon. This is a weapon capable of making extraordinarily powerful EMP fields that would exceed the hardness of our hardest command and control and missile forces, which in the congressional testimony is given as 50,000 volts per meter. That's what we're hardened at. But a super EMP weapon could make potentially up to 200,000 volts per meter, you know, eight times higher levels. So this means they could not just shut down the electric grid, but potentially they could also paralyze our military forces and our nuclear deterrent as well. And this has been known now because it was disclosed in the congressional testimony back in 2008. It's been known to the world for 8 years. So in this respect, is an area where they could get away with it, you know, by paralyzing our forces. They could also get away with it by doing an anonymous EMP attack. You know, if they detonated one of those satellites, we wouldn't necessarily know it was one of those satellites that did the EMP attack. These satellites are in low Earth orbit. They're mixed in with hundreds of other satellites. The EMP, because they come up from a southern trajectory, you know, we don't have ballistic missile early warning radars looking at that direction. We're blind and defenseless from that direction. And the EMP would damage the national technical means that we need to ascertain who attacked us. So there are several ways. You know, they could do it off of a freighter is another way you could do it to keep your fingerprints off of the attack. So, yes, and what you said about the decreasing credibility of our nuclear deterrent is tremendously alarming. There was another. We had one of the commissions that I served on, the Strategic Posture Commission, back in 2009, warned exactly that we were headed in the direction that we are in today, that you were talking about before, that our nuclear weapons and forces were fast becoming obsolete because of lack of maintenance. You know, we don't even make tritium anymore.
I know. I just saw a recent report raising a red flag about that as another coming problem for the nuclear deterrent, the capacity to boost those weapons to get the thermonuclear yields. Peter, before we let you go, I just did want to ask about one other question relevant to this WikiLeaks and the compromise of very sensitive collection capabilities by this country. It also highlighted another potential problem that one of our colleagues who has been very active with you on the effort to protect our country against electromagnetic pulse raised in a recent call with us, Dr. George Baker, namely that this Internet of Things, as it's called, could in fact open up with our refrigerators and our televisions and in the not too distant future, our automobiles being all wired into the internet or wirelessly connected, that we may well find that a new vehicle for taking down our society, a whole new level of vulnerabilities beyond just that of the electric grid itself. But very quickly, would you talk about that a little bit?
Well, you're absolutely right. And so is George Baker. And this is not, again, it's not a future thing. The North Koreans, the Chinese, the Russians, the Iranians, they're already there. When I talk about an EMP attack, we often talk about that, and we talk about it as if it's an isolation. But if you look at their military doctrines and plan, they don't plan to do a nuclear EMP attack in isolation. It's part of a combined armed cyber operation that starts with cyber attacks of exactly the kind that you're talking about, that go after the grid, that go after all their critical infrastructures, that go after everything that they can possibly disrupt using cyber means. Then it's quickly followed by physical sabotage, non-nuclear EMP attacks using radio frequency weapons, and the ultimate cyber weapon in this doctrine is a nuclear EMP attack. So it's part of a much larger sort of a blitzkrieg in cyberspace that includes all of these elements in coordinated fashion.
Yeah, all of the above, as they say.
And we're not even thinking about this. This is a major vulnerability that we're not even intellectually prepared.
Right. Well, Peter, what you've made clear to me and so many others over the years, Peter, is that this is harder to do something about if you don't build it in, this protection, this resiliency from the beginning. This whole Internet of Things concept has to be tailored to reflect that reality, it seems to me. Peter, I know they're calling your plane. You got to go. Thank you so much for your time today, my friend. Come back to us again very soon. Safe travels in the meantime. Elaine Donnelly joins us next on the chickens coming home to roost as a result of Obama's social experimentation and engineering of the military. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. Listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Jim Hansen sitting in for Frank. We have the pleasure of talking right now with Elaine Donnelly, who is founder and president of the Center for Military Readiness. Now, Elaine, you wrote a piece talking about how on Inauguration Day, President Trump was speaking about the forgotten men and women of our country, saying, "Everyone is listening to you now." Now, I think we both wish that were truly the case, and in some respects, it does seem to be getting better. But tell us a little bit of how things could be changing and need to change to do that bit of respect and consideration for all the folks who are serving this country.
Well, when I heard President Trump make those remarks, the first thought that came to my mind were the forgotten people, the men and women of our military, who have been, you could almost say, screaming at the top of their lungs in survey after survey. Every time their opinions are asked, they have said they were not in favor of women being in direct ground combat. 92.5% of Army women said they wanted nothing to do with those jobs. Certainly on the LGBT issue, survey after survey, the transgender issue, should the Department of Defense schools allow people to use the bathroom of their choice regardless of their biological gender? All of these questions have been moving forward. The agenda of President Obama has been moving forward without any restriction. There was even a directive issued about the transgender policy after the inauguration, because there are Obama holdovers still within the Pentagon. The Deputy Secretary of Defense, Robert Work, is the man who implemented all of the most obnoxious policies of the Obama administration, and he is still there as the Deputy Secretary of Defense. So let's put it this way. The administration is just starting. I am optimistic that finally there will be some realistic changes made. In fact, there already was one on the transgender school issue. The Department of Defense last October said, well, we're going to open up all the DOD schools. Mind you, this is from grade school on up to the service academies. It was a massive change in policy. They rushed ahead to do it. But now the Trump administration has pulled back on that. And thank goodness, because military families, in many cases, they have no choice but to use the Department of Defense schools. It's the largest school system in the world. So that's one down, and there's about 20-some more to go. Policies that need to be replaced, repealed, reevaluated at a minimum. And I'm optimistic that change in attitude will begin very soon.
Now, you mentioned the number two at DOD is still there, you know, from the Obama administration. There was a discussion, at least, of putting a woman, Ann Patterson, who was the former ambassador to Egypt, in as the number three. Do you think that personnel is policy, and consequently, those people should not be in those positions?
I was astonished by that news. The person in charge of policy, someone associated with the Muslim Brotherhood in her history as ambassador to Egypt, there was also talk of Michelle Flournoy being the deputy to replace Robert Work. She would be even worse because she is a woman. Now, she may have credentials in some areas of foreign policy and defense, but on the personnel policies, she and all the others, she was supposed to be Hillary Clinton's Secretary of Defense. These people don't get it. When we see sky-high pregnancy rates in the Navy going up every year, when we see sexual misconduct problems being rampant without any reduction whatsoever, and we still have people in the Pentagon pushing for quotas 25% women on every Navy ship. That was the demand of the former Vice Chief of Naval Operations, Admiral Michelle Howard. What is she thinking? When you have such a high percentage, and you know that 70-some percent of the pregnancies that occur, higher than rates in the civilian world, these are unplanned. How can this be? The so-called SHARP program, it's a Navy training program. It talks about contraceptives. Everything is very available to that cohort of people. And yet you see all these pregnancies occurring. It is time to reassess. How does this help readiness? If we're going to have 12 aircraft carriers, we're talking about bumping up the numbers of ships. How are you going to staff those ships? If you have 25% of your personnel, a good 16 to 18% getting pregnant every year at any given time, how are you going to do that without affecting everyone else in a negative way? It is so serious.
Now, Elaine, there was apparently some new information obtained under the Freedom of Information Act talking about pregnancies on Navy ships. Tell us a little bit about what that actually revealed.
Well, the FOIA request revealed documents showing that 16 of 100 Navy women had to be reassigned to shore due to pregnancy. This is up 2% since 2015. Now, when I served on the Presidential Commission in 1992, we established 10% of Navy women at that time were pregnant at any given time, about 15% each year. This percentage and number is even higher. So, again, how does this contribute to readiness? I think the Navy knows they have a problem. That's why they have stopped issuing regular detailed reports on this. I think not since 2013 have they done this. And the news in 2013 was astonishing. Even though they have doubled down on efforts to teach people about contraception, they have more information on that than any other cohort in colleges or any other similar group. And yet 50% more of the women in the military go through pregnancy unplanned. It's about 70% of that number. So something is going on here. Deployment at sea is very difficult. Young women want to start families. That's a normal thing. But if you have a percentage quota of 25%, you're asking for readiness problems. We have to stop pretending that pregnancy on the voluntary side of sexual misconduct is not a problem. On the involuntary side, you have other issues, such as sexual assault. You have a Marine Corps scandal going on right now with nude pictures being posted on Facebook, a huge embarrassment to the Marine Corps. What is going on with the culture of the Marine Corps? I am more concerned about the culture of the institution than I am about individuals, even though certainly many individuals were victimized. Some of the women posted the pictures themselves. What is that? It's juvenile behavior. You see that in high schools. You see it in colleges. You can't have it in the military running rampant. The answer is not just to put more women in combat, more women on ships, more women in combat units, in land infantry units. That's not going to solve the problem. Likely it will only make it worse. And I hasten to add this. It's not the women who should be blamed. It's the policymakers.
Now, Elaine, and one of the other issues was when these carrier groups and other naval task forces train together before they leave, having all of these people leaving during the middle of a deployment definitely affects their ability to conduct operations.
Well, that's true. In fact, if you look at the numbers of the missing pregnant sailors, it almost correlates exactly to the unfilled positions that the Navy is reporting right now. 3,898, that's the number of unfilled positions. And then when you look at the number of pregnancies occurring, August 2016, 3,840. Does anyone see a pattern here? There's also this issue of single parenthood. We need benefits to support stable families. That's a given. However, the benefits are so generous. They have become a magnet for single parents. On the commission, we determine that although there are more men who are single parents in the military, that's because there's more men, period, the percentage of women who are single parents with custody is much higher. So what are we doing here? We're losing balance between the needs of the military, that's readiness, the needs of the mother, her career, and the children. Children are pretty much left out of the picture in many cases. Readiness is suffering. the primary focus seems to be the careers of the mothers. We need a little bit more balance here. Readiness needs to be given a higher priority, and the subsidies to encourage single parenthood in all the services needs to be reassessed.
Well, Elaine, let's hope that they will be making the changes necessary because, like you said, readiness is what matters, the ability to do the mission. Elaine Donnelly, thank you so much. Up next, we will be talking with Tim Cord of the American Hitmen.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. We're going to talk right now with some of my favorite rock and rollers. This is Tim Cord of the American Hitmen, also a former Marine sergeant and a gentleman who I met for the first time on the deck of an aircraft carrier in San Diego when they rocked the USS Midway to kick off the National Heroes Tour. Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio, Tim.
Hey, thanks for having me, Jim. It's good to talk to you again, man.
Yeah, man, you guys have been dominating. You did your time on America's Got Talent. You've been rocking the world. Well, hey, yeah. I wanted to talk to you about some craziness you guys found yourself involved in and also helped kind of blow the whistle on, which was beautiful, involving some of our not friends, the Saudis. Now, there is a set of U.S. legislation designed to pay victims of 9/11 reparations, essentially, and the Saudis have been doing everything they can since they were the bulk of the 9/11 hijackers and unfortunately almost certainly involved in some of the other aspects of that. They've been trying to avoid any culpability for this, and you guys found yourselves being kind of surreptitiously and cheatingly contacted by a veterans organization that actually turned out to be funded by the Saudis. Tell us about that, man.
Our friend, or who we thought was a friend, David Niffenegger, he is a vet kind of involved in politics in Des Moines, Iowa. You guys want to fly out to D.C., stay at Trump's hotel. A group of vets are going to go on the Hill and maybe talk to Senator McCain, Lindsey Graham, about this bill called JASTA. And up to this point, we had heard nothing about it. But it was basically like a four-day paid vacation to Washington, D.C. And so Dan and I were like, oh, cool, you know, we'd like to go on there and see it.
Absolutely.
And no money was changing hands. They weren't paying us, but they paid for everything to go do it. So we were like, sweet. So we got an email, and it was from Jason Johns, who was the organizer for this event. And it was this big, long-winded email about how JASTA is detrimental to the vets. And if anybody served overseas in the Middle East, these countries can turn around the JASTA legislation against you, and you could be hemmed up by Interpol and all this. It was crazy. It was scary. And we're not politicians. We're rockers who used to be in the Marine Corps. And so we're like, well, damn, this sounds crazy. So the first night we get there, we're at Trump's hotel. We're in the Patton Room. And well, there's 40 of us there. And there's retired generals. We're all broken into groups of five or six. And Jason Johns, the leader, gets up and he basically says, thank you guys so much for coming out. This is a cause that's near and dear to our hearts. We love the 9/11 victims and their families, but we feel that this affects the vets greatly. Oh, and by the way, there have been a lot of rumors going around that the Saudis are behind this. I can assure you, this is just a group of concerned vets that are basically just saying, like he just volunteered this really random non sequitur comment. And up until that point, we were like, we never even remotely thought that Saudi Arabia had anything to do with this trip that we were taking to D.C., right?
And just so everybody understands, this bill is called the Justice Against Sponsors of Terrorism Act, JASTA. And again, the Saudis have hired a bunch of lobbyists and apparently co-opted some of these veterans groups into essentially trying to con you guys into supporting this. So now you're there at the hotel. This guy's telling you things that are making you suspicious. What's going on next?
So the next day we go out and they bring us up into groups, and we basically go to we just walk office to office in the Senate and the House. And sometimes we talk to a couple congressmen, most of the time we just talk like their senior staff. And we'd walk in with this group, and the leader of the group would say, we're a group of concerned vets here volunteering our time to discuss the language of JASTA. And so they're like, do you have any paperwork or any documentation for your group? And I'm like, oh, no, we're all just here on our own accord, right? So they wouldn't leave anything. It just looked like a group of vets just got together. So we're going to these meetings all day, and consistently through every meeting we had, the leader of our group, Daniel Tinsley, Dustin Tinsley, they were brothers. They would always say, like, we really would like to have a sit down with the 9/11 victims and their families, but due to roadblocks and legal things, we haven't been able to at this point. And that's when Dan leaned over and was just kind of like, why would the 9/11 victims and their families not want to talk to vets? Like, it just seemed really bizarre that 9/11 victims and their families would have any problem working with vets on the Shasta Bill, right? So that was our first giant red flag, right? So that night, I was sitting in the lobby of the Trump Hotel. It was like 10:30, 10:45. And Daniel Tinsley, one of the leaders, who is a wounded combat veteran, he's got a Purple Heart recipient, and he runs the Purple Heart organization in Wisconsin somewhere. Like, he's got actually a good cause. So he comes stumbling out of a conference room with this guy in a suit, who we later referred to as a lobbyist. And I was talking to my girlfriend at the time. I was totally sober, I don't drink, so I was. And he goes, oh, man, Tim, come here. I got something to tell you. And I said, well, what's up? And he is just drunk out of his mind. And he goes, oh, man, I've got such great news. I found a way to kill this bill. And so up until this point, I had no idea that that's what we were doing, was trying to kill a bill, right?
Right.
And I said, well, what do you mean? And he said, well, the guy I was just talking to, he's a lobbyist, and he found a way that if we cap the lawyer's fees at 5%, so essentially when a 9/11 victim and the family would sue the Saudis, their lawyer fees would be capped at 5% rather than the normal 33%. And he said, so no lawyer is going to take these cases, so we can basically just squash this whole thing right now. And I said, what do you mean squash it? Like, do you not really care about Jasta? And he goes, oh, no, man, I don't care about this at all. But it's a way to get my foot in the door to help my organization. So it was like he was doing this knowing full well that he was lying to all of us. And Jason Johns and his brother Justin were lying to all of us so they could get their good vet organizations in the door by rubbing elbows with those people, right? And I said, so Daniel, by the way, like, who's paying for all this, man? And he goes, dude, it's the kingdom. And I said to him, I said, the kingdom of Saudi Arabia? He goes, yeah, man, like, you know, they don't want to deal with this. So I told the guys the next morning, I told my brother, of course, there were a couple other guys at our table, our group that we got really tight with. Like, so we asked the other guys that we were with, like, did you know that this is what's going on with the Saudis? And they're like, no, we were all flown out here thinking that this is an actual vet bill that would be detrimental to us. I'm like, these are good dudes who are busy guys. And they came out there to volunteer the time for a cause that they thought was actually a cause, right?
And it's not like anybody reads, you know, it's not like people like us read the language of something like this. You're relying on somebody who's telling you, you know, it's supposed to be good for vets, and it could be hurting vets if we don't kill it. You know, I mean, you, who's going to read the language of that to find out they're lying beforehand? You hear Trump Hotel, free trip, everything paid for, and for a good cause? I'm in first and ask questions later, and unbelievable. Well, this is a...
So I messaged him the next morning. It was the Wednesday morning while we were there, and I asked him, I said, it was Wednesday, January 25th, at like 10 a.m. I said, David, did you know that who was funding this? And I didn't mention anything about the kingdom or anything. And he goes, well, we've all had our suspicions that it's the kingdom. And I said, didn't you think that you should have told us that before we went?
Seriously.
And he's like, yeah. And I have this whole thing on Facebook. I have it all. And he says, well, welcome to politics, Tim. It's either the Obamas and the Iranians or the Republicans and the Saudis. You pick your battles.
Well, I am very grateful now that you guys have blown the whistle on this, that this is out, and that we can watch this kind of disgraceful, you know, attempt to use vets to further an anti-victims of 9/11 bill. It's horrifying to watch. And I mean, you guys have done so much good for the veterans community and everybody. I am disgusted by the fact that these people tried to use you for the power of evil, and glad you figured it out.
Well, that's the thing. It's like, there's nothing more sympathetic than a 9/11 victim or their family other than a wounded combat veteran, right? So, like, they've obviously figured out how they can pull the sympathy card, like, oh, yeah, we see your 9/11 victim family. We'll raise you a Purple Heart veteran, right? Like, who's going to say no to that, right? So it's slimy. I'm only saying this because I genuinely care that vets are being lied to and being wined and dined by the goddamn Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. It's not cool with me.
Well, again, dude, glad you figured it out. Glad you raised up and slapped this down. But I'm going to tell everybody listening, if you got anybody in your family who likes rock and roll and the military, you cannot get more rock and roll military than American Hitmen. So, Tim Cord, American Hitmen, thank you so much for coming on and shining a light on this shady Saudi stuff. This is Jim Hansen, Secure Freedom Radio. We'll be right back after the break.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. To securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Jim Hansen sitting in for Frank. We're going to talk right now with Brad Patty, who spent multiple years during the surge as a tribal advisor to a succession of U.S. Brigade combat team leaders. Brad, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Jim.
Wanted to talk with you right now because we actually seem to be getting to the point where the end game might possibly be in sight. I know that's a bold statement, but we've heard that Baghdadi may be on the run. And we've also heard now that there is a deployment of U.S. troops into Syria. Now, that's a fairly significant departure. And there's been some discussion amongst U.S. leadership about what that might entail and what it might take to basically lock things up in Syria. Well, what do you make of all that?
Well, in terms of the deployment, it looks like it's going to be elements of the 11th Marine Expeditionary Unit and the 3rd Battalion, 75th Rangers. The Marines look like an artillery battery, and they officially say that they're there to provide fire support to U.S.-led forces, but indigenous forces in Syria. That's sort of the recipe that worked in the early stages of Afghanistan, as you know, except it was air support, but, you know, with special operations guys directing fire, worked really well. Plausibly, it could work here, too. Now, the 3rd Battalion of the 75th Rangers, that's a different animal. I mean, they aren't really saying what they're doing there.
They tend to break things and conduct raids.
Yeah, and in the past they have spearheaded larger efforts by the regiment as a whole. Jack Murphy, who was a 3rd BAT guy and also a 5th group guy at one point, had a piece on that in the last couple of days, and he mentioned that because they're co-located with regimental headquarters, sometimes the 3rd BAT goes in to lay the groundwork for the other units because it's easier for them to coordinate those opening efforts with headquarters. So that could be the beginning of something really big, or it could be them sending a battalion to break things and conduct raids. We don't really know yet.
All that makes sense, and I think the idea that a Marine artillery unit capable of operating in somewhat denied territory is eminently useful, especially if you also have a maneuver unit who can go and look to see what's going on and potentially exploit anything that's happening. So both of those make a fair amount of sense. Given the fact that now we hear potentially Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, the caliph of the caliphate, the leader of ISIS, the big kahuna, may have bugged out of Mosul. If that's the case, we're looking at, you know, not just ISIS abandoning areas where they may not have been as strong, but that was one of their big wins, was taking Mosul. And now I think if that's gone, if they're under pressure, all the rest of it, are they potentially in a position where they may be looking to move the whole game elsewhere?
Well, you know, I'm always a little suspicious when I hear in the press that Baghdadi has done this or that, but there have been a couple of reports lately, and one of them is that he sent orders for everyone to prepare to move and to conduct terrorism elsewhere. So that's certainly possible. Now, in terms of him personally fleeing the city, there is a report to that effect. If I were running American efforts, I would be putting out propaganda reports to that effect, because we don't call it propaganda when we do it. We call it information operations. But I would actually do it exactly the way that the North did to Jefferson Davis in the American Civil War, and claim that he fled wearing women's clothes.
Which, in cases we've already seen some of the ISIS fighters doing, leaving in burqas, conducting operations in burqas, and then getting scarfed up. So that's not out of the question.
So, Brad, if we're looking now at U.S. troops in Syria pressuring them, you know, difficulty for ISIS to maintain their base of operations in Iraq, who's going to own the ground when it's done? You know, there was a point in time where after the 2008 time frame, the surge was successful. Al-Qaeda in Iraq had been basically beaten into submission. And we were looking at the possibility of a federal Iraq. The government was stood up. What do you do now? Iran has far too much influence. The Baghdad government is relatively compromised. The Shia militias, which are essentially proxies for Iran, are the ones who have done much of the clearing and now are in possession of a lot of the battlefield. They're looting it. They're committing war crimes. Who's going to be on the ground running things if ISIS is gone?
Well, that is actually the question that we need to be thinking about right now. Ever since the Iran deal, Russia has been openly backing Iran's play in Syria and to a certain degree in Iraq as well. And Iran has really run the table in terms of setting itself up with local allies. Our new ambassador to the UN, Nikki Haley, said that, quote, "We need to get Iran and their proxies out," unquote. Well, getting Iran out, that's an extremely hard problem. Getting their proxies out is impossible because their proxies are local citizens. That's where they belong. There's nowhere to get them out to. A lot of this is built around Iranian efforts to organize Shias around the defense of Shiite holy places, especially the Saeed Zanab Mosque in Syria. But, you know, it's all across this region. And in Iraq, groups like the Iraq version of Hezbollah have openly declared loyalty to the supreme leader of Iran and said, you know, we're prepared to overthrow our government anytime he says so. So Iraq's government has theoretically passed a law last year that, you know, these popular mobilization forces, as they call them, these Iranian-backed Shia militias, they're allowed to fight. But then after the war is over, they have to demobilize. And I think we all know that's not really going to happen, but that's allegedly what the plan is.
I think we're running awful low on allies in the region. You know, at this point, with the Iranian-backed militias, who will end up in some quasi-official control of a lot of these areas, nobody's really left. ISIS killed so much of the leadership in Al-Anbar, the Sunni areas are in complete disarray and now are deeply divorced from any love there ever was with the Baghdad government, which is all Shia and Iranian-backed. The Kurds have their own nation-state in everything but a name. So there's really not much left other than hopefully, you know, okay, if we create a vacuum by moving ISIS out, that is a net gain. But at this point, I haven't heard a good plan for filling it. Now, the discussion has been around, do we conduct some sort of partition? You know, do we actually finally recognize the Kurds, give them a nation state, and move on from there?
Yeah, that's a very plausible idea, except for the fact that one of our major NATO allies in Turkey is going to be completely opposed to it, as will both the Iranian government and therefore the Iraqi government. So this would have to be done by fiat of the United States, and we would have to provide whatever it took to support it. It might also break up NATO because Turkey might just decide not to continue to work with us on anything if we took away the Kurdish areas. And since NATO does things by unanimous consent, and there's no mechanism for expelling Turkey, then that means that NATO can't really do anything anymore if the Turks refuse to go along.
But what if we could convince Turkey to leave NATO through doing that? Like you said, we can't expel them. I'm not convinced they're an ally anymore. So I understand the difficulty there, but I'm also not sure that's not a lever worth using.
Yeah, that's almost certainly true. Inside of Turkey, there is within Istanbul and a few other places a class of highly educated, relatively secular, Western-looking Turks who look back to Ataturk and his secularization, modernization efforts as really the core of what their country ought to be about. These are very decent people, but they're totally out of power right now. And the guy who is in power, Erdogan, is openly an Islamist and flirting with Russia, flirting with China, and, you know, really trying to negotiate a piece of the Kurdish regions larger than he already has with the Iranians and the Iraqis and the Syrians. That he would just sort of like to absorb some additional territory out of that. So can you get him out of NATO? I don't know. It depends on how dumb he is. He doesn't have to leave, and it's to his advantage to stay in and foil NATO's ability to do anything.
Brad, we have a big challenge in front of us, but I'm going to go ahead and be optimistic that at least killing ISIS is a net gain for the world. What we do next is going to be a challenge, but it will be better in the long run. Brad Patty, former tribal advisor in Iraq and a noted scholar on this issue. Thank you so much for joining us. And that's going to wrap up Secure Freedom Radio for today. I'll be back tomorrow sitting in for Frank, bringing you more ammunition in the war of ideas and the fight for the free world.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.